favorite scary movie. Have you checked the children?
It's all for you!
We have such sights to show you.
Need to adjust our Spanish accents.
Right?
Let's turn that to 14. Okay, cool.
Let's go back to our high school Spanish classes.
Now an Enye is, oh, I can do it.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah, fuck it.
Let's go ahead and get started. Welcome, everyone, to episode 51 of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex Webster. And as always, I am joined by Anthony Fuentes.
Thanks for not quitting after 50 episodes. We appreciate the support.
You might quit after today because we are probably going to be very isolating.
As a Latino, I should not butcher these accents, but I'm probably going to.
Okay.
I'm going to do a couple. I'm sorry.
With the last name like Fuentes.
Yeah, who would have expected me to be able to pronounce shit?
Anyway, today we are covering The Devil's Backbone from 2001. It is a Spanish film directed by Guillermo del Toro, who is a personal hero of mine.
Oh my god, he's my favorite.
He's
one of my favorites.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I saw him... Quick anecdote before we get started. I saw him at Comic-Con in 2012.
Really?
2012 or 2013, I want to say. No, it couldn't have been 2013. 2011 or 2012, presenting both Pacific Rim and Crimson Peak.
Oh, wow.
And it was only, it was Pacific Rim, like, it was, like, just the very first promo, like, video, and it was, like, 15 seconds long, and it was just the Jaegers, and I was just like, oh, my God. And then he only discussed Crimson Peak. Like, he had just mentioned, he was just like, I'm doing a gothic horror film. And
oh,
I was
wow.
just like, and then that was it. And I was just entranced. Like, that was the first I'd ever actually seen him. Like, I had like, heard of him, but, like, I had actually seen him and heard him talk. And he's just so fucking funny.
Yeah.
He's
awesome.
Funny dude. So, ever since that, I was just, like, hard eyes. So,
that's
great.
Oh, it's a shame those movies underperformed. Both of them.
Wait, well, you know, it's so funny that you say that, because Pacific Rim is, like, one of my favorite movies ever.
It's good. I love it.
And it has such a... specific fan, like, borderline cult following. Like,
yeah.
People, if you like Pacific Rim, there's people who don't like Pacific Rim and people who are fucking obsessed with Pacific Rim. Like, there's, like, very few people who are just like, I liked it, but I'm not, like,
yeah.
You know?
I think there's an overlap of also Evangelion fans that were, like, looking
That's
for
true.
More content.
That is very true. And I did also love Evangelion.
There you go. Oh, see, my Del Toro experience is, like, Pan's Labyrinth. It's one of the first, like, independent films I went to actually go out of my way, because of a Roger Ebert review.
Mm-hmm.
Ebert reviewed it, and he just fucking gushed over it. And,
yeah.
You know, you grow up as a Latino, you don't have a lot of people who make it besides Antonio Banderas. So I was like, okay, I'll see what this director's about. And then seeing it, and I took my friend from Mexico to watch it, and he was so sad at the end of it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
well, it's a terribly sad ending, so
yeah. And I was like, these are the kind of movies I want to watch. He's like, because up to tell you, we just watched Transformers and Batman and shit, like,
right.
And that, like, changed my mind. And he's like, let's go back to the crowd pleasers.
Yeah. No, we're gonna talk about it, but The Devil's Backbone is an amazing movie. And
I was telling Maria when we were watching it, it's Ghost Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
It's
so funny because, like, even the special effects, you can tell that, like, Guillermo del Toro, like, his universe, like, every single movie he does is in, like, the same universe in his head.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, the ghosts all look the same. Like, the ghosts here look the same like they do in Crimson Peak.
Yeah, he's got a very consistent vision.
And I think that was what fucking threw me for a loop, because Santi in this movie, like, there's this moment where you see, like, blood coming from his head.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of a, like, visual, like special effect that mm-hmm. that happens in Crimson Peak, and I'm like,
really?
Yeah.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I fucking love Crimson Peak. So
I still haven't seen that one yet.
I've seen it many, many times. So, and I'll point it out, and I think you'll notice mm-hmm. when you watch it. But yeah, it's really cool. You can kind of tell. And then the this isn't actually in the episode or in the outline, so I'm gonna just tell you now.
Mm-hmm.
The boys from the orphanage at the end of the movie, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Are actually the freedom fighters in the mountains in Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, that's cool. That's badass.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, that blew my mind. I got, because I watched Pan's Labyrinth like a million fucking times.
I've never seen it. So.
You've never, oh, dude. All
I've
right.
never seen it.
Okay, well, this, like every year, guys, we're gonna pop off with the director and just keep doing movies from them. So Del Toro, last year was Carpenter. So Del Toro's our Carpenter for season two. Just so you know. Mm-hmm. Anyways, should we get into this shit?
Yes, let us. We've gushed enough about Guillermo del Toro. I'm going to talk a lot about him later, but yeah, let's get into The Devil's Backbone.
Let's try not to fuck this up. El Espinazo del Diablo from 2001. Yeah, that was bad.
Espinazo del Diablo.
Espinazo del Diablo. All right, cool. So, IMDb synopsis. Let's fucking do it. After Carlos, a 12-year-old whose father has died in the Spanish Civil War, arrives at an ominous boys' orphanage, he discovers the school is haunted and has many dark secrets which he must uncover.
And does he uncover them?
Oh my god. Dude, I love him as a protagonist so much, though.
Carlos is the cutest 12-year-old ever. Like, he is so, like, wholesome, and he's mm-hmm. just trying to figure things out.
And he's, like, more educated than the other ones, and they're like, ah, this fucking big britches guy kind of with a suitcase and shit, and your tutor or whatever it is, and I'm just like, I know what it's like to be that kid.
And then the new tutor kid just fucking ditches him and it's just like, bye.
He's like, yeah. He pieces out and he runs. Oh, that desperate Del Toro low angle run shot is the best.
That was really sad. Like, I think that was like 5 minutes into the fucking movie, and I was just like, this is gonna be a lot.
Yeah, this is how they're popping us off, huh? Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, and this is actually starring. So it is Fernando Tielve as Carlos, the an orphan. That's a good designation there.
That's his job. He's a professional orphan.
Inigo Garces as Jaime, the orphanage bully who later befriends Carlos. This has its origins in, I wouldn't say origins, but there's a, have you ever heard of a movie called Los Olvidados?
I think it was mentioned in one of the articles I read.
Oh, really? Okay, then. I didn't read the articles, actually, but some of them.
The ones that you gave me to read?
I read, like, two of them, and one of them just sounded good. It might have been that one. But, Jaime is very similar to a character named El Jaibo in that film. It's a very fundamental Mexican film
Civil War, right?
No, it's not a Spanish Civil War film. Oh. It's actually just like a Italian New Wave style film done by Luis Buñuel, but he shot it in Mexico because he couldn't shoot shit in Europe anymore.
Oh, wow.
But the type of character he is based, it feels like, in that, which is kind of this dickish fucking bully.
I love his character, like, archetype, where it's just, like, this, like, super bully who, like, later befriends the protagonist. Like, I'm like, that is, like, so wholesome to me.
Oh, you know what? I'm missing it, actually, because, like, some of his elements go to him, but then also the other piece of shit, the older guy.
Yeah.
He's gets a lot of the El Jaibo things, too. Mm-hmm. He's a very fundamental bully-style character that I think a lot of later Mexican films pull from there. And, like, this is kind of a weird take on it, which, like, really freaks me out.
Yeah. This is, well, also, for context, I know nothing. I know very little about, like, Mexican cinema. I know very little about Spanish cinema. Like, I know very little. So, I'm... Pardon any ignorant statement I may or may not make.
I know here and there, but not enough, again, to be an authority. But you know, again, we're still casting. All right, so so we have Eduardo Noriega as Jacinto, the caretaker.
The piece of shit.
Yeah. He's
which was unfortunate because, like, the second he was on screen, I'm like, you're evil, but you're hot, which sucks.
That's where the El Jaibo character comes from. Like, oh, like that's being, the like, base.
Really?
Yeah, because he's the one that gets the ladies and does all the shit, but just fucked up. Like, super fucked up. And just, ugh. Except Los Olvidados is not a horror film, but it ends really fucked up, actually. So we got Marisa Paredes as Carmen, the administrator of the orphanage. She's the older lady, right?
Yes.
No leg?
Yeah, she's the one with the missing leg.
Missing leg.
Is used as there's a dramatic moment, and she's like, when I lost my leg.
Yeah.
Okay, we get it. You're missing your leg.
A little hint of novella in there, a little bit. ¿Por qué? So then we got, what is it? Federico Lupi as Dr. Casares, the orphanage doctor, who I like him. He's so sad. He's a sad sack.
Him, I think one of the videos we watched compared him to one of the older, like, doctor types in Pan's Labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, wow. Yeah. Guillermo del Toro has, like, archetypes that he casts, does. Too.
But they're, like, del Toro archetypes. They're his own little thing.
Yeah, they're what he creates, obviously. Yeah. But, like, I think, yeah, I liked his, I enjoyed his character.
Yeah. No, me too. There's a scene we'll have to talk about later on that I'm like, that's so... his character. Then we got Junio Valverde as Santi, an orphan who becomes a ghost. Happens.
Yeah, he is a prevalent ghost, so mm-hmm. I'm glad he gets a cast credit in this.
You know, and it does ghost really well, because mm-hmm. it's not like, ooh, here's mystery. It's like, no, this ghost actually pops out and like has a face and gets up in there. Mm-hmm. He's a character, which I think is cool. And then we have Arin Vicedo as Conchita, Jacinto's fiance.
I am so glad you did the cast for this, because my pronunciation in my head was so different.
My mom is from Mexico.
Right, but like I...
She is also half German though, so... I don't know. I'm a mix of influences. Anyways, this is, of course, directed by our boy Guillermo del Toro, one of my fucking favorites. And when he won that Oscar, man, a little part of my heart just like, let's see. Oh, fuck you. This is produced by Agustin Almodavar. This is where I fuck up. Agustin Almodavar?
Almodavar.
Okay. Produced by him. And then Bertha Navarro. Oh, Bertha Navarro is a cool name.
Yeah.
Bertha. Yeah, that's a weird mix, too. Well, my mom... Oh, I can't say that, actually. I was going to say my mom's middle name. I'm like, it's a German name. but written by, of course, Guillermo del Toro, David Munoz, and Antonio Trashoras. Trashoras?
Yeah.
Trashora, not trash aura. Trash aura.
That one was the one where I was like, I'm not even gonna bother.
Trash hour. Anthony Trash Hour. That should be my name on this fucking on this podcast.
Anthony Trash Hour Fuentes.
Yep. Just where I talk about something not horror related, but still a little
But you still vent. You still get to vent. Work out that aggression.
Like, and that's why I hate conservatives. Okay. This is budgeted at $4.5 million estimated, and had an opening weekend of way less than that. Holy shit. $34,000. Okay.
In the United States.
In the U.S. Okay. And it grossed just under $1 million, actually just over $700,000 in the U.S. with a cumulative worldwide of $6.5 million. So obviously did better elsewhere.
Right. But also notoriously, especially in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. foreign films weren't doing great in America.
In America, after fucking 9/11, and we're just like, don't be putting that Spanish film in my theater.
Mm-mm. Yeah, absolutely. Like, there was no fucking way. Like, it sucks. There was no way this movie was gonna do well in America.
You're like, I'm not gonna play this trash aura shit right here.
Show you some trash aura.
He's probably a really good fucking writer. I'm sorry. Anyways, you gotta teach us a little bit, though, because, again, I'm actually going dark on this one. This is an Alex Webster episode.
Yes, it is.
So give me a little bit of fucking Del Toro history here. Yeah, our new boy. For season two.
So I'm going to start it off with a quote from an academic article that I found. Del Toro uses the fantastical to say something profound about the historical.
Ooh.
Which I think is a wonderful like zinger quote to use just to completely encapsulate Guillermo del Toro in a nutshell.
That's concise AF. That's right there. Yeah. I think that's perfect.
So before we can talk about the movie, we need to talk about the man, the myth, the legend himself, Guillermo del fucking Toro.
Del fucking Toro. GDFT.
God, so Guillermo del Toro was born in Guadalajara,
Jalisco,
Mexico, to an extremely strict Catholic household.
Ooh. Yeah. We all know those Mexicans, yes.
When Del Toro was about 8 years old, he began experimenting with his father's Super 8 camera, making short films with Planet of the Apes toys and other objects around his house.
Oh, man.
One short focused on a, quote, serial killer potato with ambitions of world domination. It murdered Del Toro's mother and brothers before stepping outside and being crushed by a car.
Oh, that's so adorable.
What a great cohesive story.
Oh, that's amazing. He's like, let me kill my whole fucking family.
And then this potato step outside only to be crushed by a car.
With the most benign death possible. Or even that. A potato.
Yeah. Del Toro made about 10 short films before his first feature, including one titled Matilde. But only the last two.
Doña Lupe
and Geometrica.
Geometria? Yes.
Thank you. Have been made available. Del Toro also studied special effects and makeup with special effects artist Dick Smith. He spent 10 years as a special effects makeup designer and formed his own company.
Nercopia?
Yeah, that.
My accent might go back and forth, guys. I'm sorry.
You're doing great.
Thank you.
I think you're doing great. I'm just like, it sounds spot on.
Every time you say one word, I'm like, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. This is great. No, this is, I'm sure, how you feel anytime there's a French word, and I'm just,
oh, my,
like,
God. Yes. Okay, good. Good. That's actually, if you want to listen to, oh, my God, when we do an Alexandre Aja film, that's going to be. Okay, let's go.
He also co-founded the Guadalajara International Film Festival, because why the fuck not?
Yeah. He's on the board of the Wagga Wagga Film Festival. See our 2 weeks ago episode.
Yeah, see Lake Mungo for more information. Later in his directing career, he formed his own production company, The Tequila Gang.
Oh, I love that. Oh, I want to do like a Halo clan, like The Tequila Gang. That's awesome.
Del Toro is known for his variety of critically acclaimed works. One is, of course, The Devil's Backbone, which we are discussing now, and Pan's Labyrinth from 2006, which also takes place during the Spanish Civil War. He's also delved into action-adventure films like Hellboy and Pacific Rim.
Mm-hmm.
So he likes a wide variety of films.
He does. And he also did some American horror early on, too, with Mimic.
Yes, which we will discuss at length later in the production.
Yeah.
So you will be discussing Mimic and why it fucked him over tremendously.
Oh, man. Okay, yeah. I've read actually a little bit of that on my own, mm-hmm. but I'm anxious to just do it again. All right, cool.
Horror and all things macabre have always had a special place in his heart. Del Toro actively collects a variety of gothic oddities and monster memorabilia. Del Toro's favorite film monsters are Frankenstein's monster, the alien, Gillman, Godzilla, and the Thing. See our episode on the Thing for more information.
That's right. Good monster to pull from, yeah.
Frankenstein in particular has special meaning for him in both film and literature. He says he has a, quote, Frankenstein fetish to a degree that is unhealthy. And that it is, quote, the most important book of my life. So, you know, if I get to it, whenever I get to it, it will be done the right way, unquote.
Oh, my God.
Which means that he's considered doing a Frankenstein movie, in which case I will lose my goddamn mind.
I can't wait until he does that. Oh, my God. That actually got me fucking hyped right there, dude.
He also has Brazil, Nosferatu, Freaks, and Bram Stoker's Dracula listed among his favorite movies.
You know, I can actually see this obsession, though, because I went to his LACMA exhibit.
I don't want to hear about it. I wanted to go so fucking bad.
I did, dude. I got to see all his props, a little display of the interior of his...
Okay,
his little freak house, whatever it is. What?
I just need... I'm pausing my whole spiel, and I need you to just talk to me about it.
It was awesome. You literally walked through LACMA, and then it had the props from each of his films. It was designated by film. And then he got to take a picture in front of this big old wall that was emulated after his house that he does all his creative shit in. And if you guys want to see me in front of it, it's on my Tinder profile. Gets me a lot of stuff. So, yeah, it's there. That's where that is. It actually...
I can't find you on Tinder. We're friends on Facebook.
Right, right. It's in my Facebook profile somewhere, too. But yeah, you got to see, like, even the little things. But the best one was the fawn from Pan's Labyrinth was right in front. And it's fucking huge. It's, like, big.
Well, also, yeah, because... Doug Jones is, like, 7 feet tall. Yeah, like, he's obnoxiously tall.
He was propped in it. So, yeah, you can definitely tell. But yeah, it was honestly fucking amazing. They had a lot of Frankenstein shit. Like, a lot of Frankenstein shit. Which is why this makes so much sense to me. Because, yeah, you can obviously tell he's a very big fan. And that this is, like, his creative... He surrounds himself with his props. And you can definitely see just, like, how that engages him. Like, it's awesome.
That's... I wanted to go so fucking bad.
And... I'm surprised I didn't buy the book. Like, they had it. Yeah. Fucked up. I was poor, all right? I could barely afford the trip there. I didn't live in LA yet.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah, because this is, like, forever ago. I was in college. Mm. So, Del Toro is also highly interested, a.k.a. obsessed, with Victorian culture.
Yep, you can see that for sure, too. Yeah.
Yeah, he said, I have a room of my library at home called the Dickens Room. It has every work by Charles Dickens, Wilkie Collins, and many other Victorian novelists, plus hundreds of works about Victorian London and its customs, etiquette, architecture. And then also goes on to say, quote, I am a Jack the Ripper aficionado, too. My museum / home has a huge amount of Ripperology in it.
Oh, my God. I want to see Del Toro do a Jack the Ripper fucking movie.
Oh, jeez. That would be wild. That'd be scary as shit.
Dude, because I did not like From Hell, so I have been waiting for someone to do it right. Mm. Like... And that would be cool. Him doing Frankenstein and Ripper. Dude, I wish he just made more money.
Ron Perlman plays Jack the Ripper.
Oh my God. That would be good. I can dig that too. All right.
I think that's another fun tidbit that didn't make it into the episode. The Devil's Backbone, mm-hmm. as of 2019, is the only film that does not have either Doug Jones or Ron Perlman in it.
Oh, that's so... Well, it's like his... Like a Mexican production. Though,
right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they were just outside.
It is tried and true. Like, mm-hmm. yeah. But also, like... If you think about it, like, there was no... I mean, Doug Jones. Who's Doug Jones going to be?
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
yeah.
He couldn't have been Santi. Anyway, Del Toro views horror as a political vehicle as well. And it's impossible to separate the two, in his opinion, in a similar vein to fantasy for him in that sense. Mm-hmm. He explained, much like fairy tales, there are two facets to horror. One is pro-institution, which is the most reprehensible type of fairy tale. Don't wander into the woods and always obey your parents. Mm. The other type of fairy tale is completely anarchic and anti-establishment.
Which is why he hasn't done a Disney film. This is why he hasn't done a Disney film.
This quote is just like, I fucking love it. It just makes me so happy. Like, it makes me like respect him
a lot,
so
dude,
much. Like,
seriously,
I'm just like, you are such a badass.
He is badass. Right when you finish reading that, I'm like, dude, bad fucking ass. That's right.
Well, and he like practices what he preaches. Like, none of his films are ever like establishment, because he's super anti-establishment.
He
always has been. Like, even in this movie, like, it's super like, fuck the man. Mm-hmm. Like, you know.
You're like, oh, I know we're losing the war right now, but, you know, fuck these guys. Fuck the fascists. Like, this is a very anti-fascist film.
Well, all of his movies are very anti-fascist.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, of course, Pan's Labyrinth is also super, super.
Oh, yeah. Which is why he doesn't work for Disney.
Of course. I think he would probably rather die.
No, yeah, I think same here.
He owns two houses devoted exclusively to his collection of books, poster artwork, and other belongings pertaining to his work, which is where the LACMA... Mm-hmm. Thing came from.
Yeah, they pulled a lot of his stuff from the interiors of those homes. Yeah.
He explains, quote, as a kid, I dreamed of having a house with secret passages and a room where it rained 24 hours a day. The point of being over 40 is to fulfill the desires you've been harboring since you were 7.
Oh my God.
This guy makes me want to live past 40.
Seriously, just one more decade. One more.
But no, so that's just a little bit about a little insight into the psyche of Guillermo del Toro, and this is just kind of why I love him so much.
Oh my God, that's awesome. I love that.
Yeah.
Dude. Oh, again, we're going to be doing more Del Toro films this season, guys.
Yeah,
I already
have ones
on my list.
Well, there's already one that we have definitely on the books planned for the near future, so.
Okay. Yes. Oh, but to get into a little bit to understand this film, of course, and then Del Toro overall, we actually have to take ourselves even back further. So we're going to give a little bit of a brief Spanish Civil War context thing here.
Which is great, because like I mentioned before, I know nothing about the Spanish Civil War. I think when I initially wrote out the outline, I did not call it the Spanish Civil War. I called it something else, and it was not the Spanish Civil War. Like, it was the wrong war, and I was like, this isn't right.
I've been studying the wrong thing for 3 hours!
That would have been awful.
Oh, that's hilarious. Okay, before the context again of the film, here is a brief, very brief overview of the Spanish Civil War, because we are not a history podcast, not a in this far back. And this isn't world history class, because by now we've all graduated from high school, I hope. Yeah.
Please.
We went to college. We're fine. Yeah. So,
well, or at least I hope anyone listening has graduated from high school, because we are pretty explicit. Yeah.
Even if you didn't graduate from high school, I just hope you guys are intellectually curious. How about that?
Okay, sure.
Yes. But the Spanish Civil War was a conflict in Spain in the years leading up to World War II between 1936 and 1939. The war was fought mostly across the eastern side of Spain, but also traveled as far inland as Madrid.
Want to do that line over?
Yes. The war was fought mostly across the eastern side of Spain, but also traveled as far inland as Madrid. Fighting was focused around the fascist nationalists led by almost, but not quite, dictator Francisco Franco versus the Republicans, which were mainly communists and anarchists. So, people you wouldn't see associating with the term Republican today here in America, just saying. Yeah,
that
definitely
was fun
not.
To see in the research where it was like the Republicans that were all anarchists and communists, well, and people that were just like, fuck the man. And I was just like, nice.
Well, you know what a lot of fascists end up doing is co-opting terminology that their opponents use, which is why Republicans are like, hey, we're all about democracy. No, you're fucking not. Sorry. Sorry for Republican listeners with this current administration. Fuck not.
Yeah.
See, reading about the Civil War got me. All right. By the time all was said and done, 610,000 people had died and over 500,000 people had fled the country to avoid the fascist regime of Francisco Franco, who would rule over Spain until his regime fell with his death in the mid-70s. Fuck,
it was like,
dude.
Yeah, it was like 1973 or 5 or something like that.
Oh,
like,
my
I was
gosh.
Like, God.
That's
he lived forever.
Insane. Yeah.
Why do dictators live forever?
They don't give a fuck. They don't care about things, so things don't affect them in the same way. That's why assholes live for, like, it literally, they don't have the stress of giving a shit about anything but themselves.
That sucks.
Francisco Franco, piece of shit. I have studied this in some YouTube videos prior. The World War II really... Oh, right, of course, here it is. Of course, 5 months after the Civil War ended in 1939, World War II started in September, and the Spanish Civil War and the trauma it inflicted were largely forgotten by the international community. That's actually the point I was about to make right now.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, World War II actually just swept this bitch under the rug big time.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, I don't want to say it's only for like 3 years, but it was, I mean, relatively short, all things considered.
Mm-hmm. I mean, our own Civil War in America was, what, 4?
Right.
So, yeah, when you, like...
This but when it, a... when it's, one of the things that I believe, last podcast on the left did a Haunted Battlefields episode,
mm-hmm.
For the Civil War, and here in America, and they talked about why Civil Wars typically cause so much trauma and hauntings,
mm-hmm.
Because it's, like, there's a certain level of trauma of having to fight, basically, your neighbor.
Yes.
And it's people who look and sound and basically are... you know, your brethren.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a culture battle for what?
Yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah, for
so,
what?
And that's what makes it particularly hard, and the ghosts particularly scary.
Mm-hmm. And it's, again, this is a civil war, so it's not like people are certain on their side. Some people take a little bit of here and a little bit of there, and they don't want to fight, but they have to fight because fighting is brought to their front door.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You kind of don't have much of a choice.
Don't have much of a choice, exactly. And I like how this movie shows you, like, the insides of people who, like, what they have to put up with. Because, you know, one of them's a spy, and he sees the execution of one of his associates.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, he has to keep his fucking mouth shut.
And he has to just keep going.
Yep,
yeah.
Because there's a climate that you're... Part of the war is the battlefield, the other part of the war is behind the scenes.
Definitely.
Yeah, which is fucking... God, this movie did so good.
Yeah, it did it really well. And then also, like, just the... Like, even the children, where a lot of them are led to believe that their family is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of that. And just, like, one of the things that I think was so cool that what Guillermo del Toro did with this is mm-hmm. his grandparents fled Spain
mm-hmm.
During the Spanish Civil War. And that's why, like, I think this story in particular is something that's, like, so prevalent. Because,
yeah.
like, it's something not a lot of people talk about. Like, mm-hmm. even in, like, I mean, I think, if anything, this was, like, a sentence in a history book for
me. It's always a footnote.
It's always
a footnote, yeah.
So it's one of those things where it's, like, you know, we don't learn about it here in America.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's very often swept under the rug. I'm pretty sure also in Spain. Like, I don't think it's, like, a huge thing even openly discussed.
Oh, you mean after fucking decades of a fascist dictator, you can't talk about his fucking conflict?
The war that led... led to, like, him gaining power? What?
Yeah, yeah, you can't talk about the opposition that he had in a positive light. What? Yeah,
or, you know, that, or the, you know, it's very similar to something like, you know, we don't talk about the Trail of Tears Mm-mm. very often. Or
I like that we do more now, though.
Now we do. Growing up, yeah. Not so much. For me, anyway.
But, I mean, it's also another thing, too, in America, why a lot of our history books end just, at, like, in the 1950s.
That's true.
And they do Vietnam to 9/11 really in a month?
Yeah, I think I had a history book that had like the Cuban Missile Crisis and we were like, ooh.
Yeah. But like but like up until Vietnam, after that they just speed through. And even Vietnam they're like touch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My brother got a history book that covered 9/11.
Oh, obviously we haven't been in school in a long time. Yeah.
Because, yikes.
How long did they spend on it, though?
I honestly don't know. But, like, my brother was born in 2003.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Yeah, after 9/11. That's true.
Hey, folks.
I would hope that they spend time on the Reagan era, man, because, like, but, like what, everything...
Right.
That, yeah.
But, all like, the history books have gotten updated to the point that where you're getting things like the Reagan administration. You're getting things, like, leading up to, you know, like, 9/11.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
From what I've read, though, they really only spend, like, a month on it. Month and a half.
Well, I mean,
and I'm like, and I'm talking about Reagan, and I'm talking about like 40, 50 years of American history past Vietnam. Like,
they yada yada through a lot.
Yeah, they yada yada through a lot of shit that got us to our situation, which is unfortunate. Yeah. But you know what? Yeah. Education, that's how you control the masses, right?
But again, we're not a history podcast.
No, we're not. I'm getting too hot reading about this. All right, production.
So let's chat about this fucking movie.
How it got made. All right. So, Guillermo del Toro wrote The Devil's Backbone when he was in college, and it took 16 years before it ever saw the light of day. Damn.
He's been holding on to it.
It's a labor of love right here. Shit. Before it did get that chance, like everything, the fucking Weinsteins got in the way. God damn. I just hate reading their fucking names sometimes. Yeah. Even though I like Scream, I'm like, dude. Oh, when we cover Scream, there's going to be some Weinstein bullshit on that one. Anyways, Del Toro was set to make his big debut in the United States with 1997's Mimic, which was produced by Miramax. Instead, because the production went to shit and the creative disagreements between Del Toro and the Weinsteins, the movie wasn't what either party really had in mind, and Del Toro's American debut was lackluster at best.
Yeah, Mimic didn't do great.
No, and I rented Mimic back in the day. I used to love it, actually.
Well, it's such a great concept.
Yeah.
Like, it's a cool concept, but...
Mm-hmm. Not well executed, no. I mean, even as a kid, I think I just liked the creature look. Like, I thought the effects were fucking awesome.
This is, like, the equivalent of, like, I loved League of Extraordinary Gentlemen as a kid. But, like, it doesn't make it a good movie.
Good? No, that is a very good comparison right there. And I have given Alex shit on her love of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. So.
Like, I love that movie. It doesn't make it good.
Yeah, you're right. That's my Mimic right there.
I mean, I did re-listen to the We Hate Movies episode for it the other day, and I was crying with laughter at my desk.
I fucking love that. Dude, they did a Final Destination 3.
I was listening to it, like, yesterday.
I was playing Smash Brothers listening to it. I was having a time.
It was so fun. Anyway.
Anyway, yeah. Del Toro explains that at the time, the Weinsteins were considered golden. Quote, golden in the industry.
Fuckers.
Fucking dipshit. Okay. Most people assume the faults in Mimic must have sprung from Del Toro as a filmmaker rather than the Weinstein interference, which, again, as we cover more Weinstein-produced films, you're going to see that shit a lot. People blame the filmmakers, and it's the fucking Weinsteins every time.
Well, also, again, this is 1997. This is Guillermo del Toro's first American film. Like, he doesn't have the cred that he has now of Guillermo del fucking Toro.
And think how hyped he was finally to be able to make an American film. Our third biggest export.
Yeah.
Hollywood films.
Yeah.
And he was about to have a chance with it working with, like, the hot shit Weinsteins, and they fuck him. Oof. Other fascists.
the other fascists of the film industry. Hollywood fucking fascists. Fucking Weinsteins.
Oh, God.
Again, we are still staunchly anti-Weinstein.
Anti-Weinstein, anti-fucking Landis, anti-incel.
That's
our brand. Anti-Reagan, too. Anyways, to quote Del Toro here, eventually, over the years, more information emerged, but at the time, people said, God knows what happened on Mimic. So,
poor Del Toro.
I know, yeah. He just got the shit in. Yeah, like right over the fucking brown person trying to succeed in America, you know? know. Sorry. Anyways, after Mimic, Del Toro found American film work hard to come by, fuckers. He had pitched a proposal for what would become The Devil's Backbone to the Mexican Institute of Film, but they rejected the idea because they thought it was, quote, too big of a movie.
Which is very interesting considering that there's, like, two sets in this entire movie.
Yeah, right? Like, a field and the actual home.
Yeah, like, there's, like, the orphanage and, like...
The basement of the orphanage?
Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, and then somebody gets shot on the outside of the orphanage in, like, a Breaking field. Bad field. Yeah, that's where fucking... Walter White fucking hides the bodies, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyways...
did you watch the movie?
Is it out?
Yeah. Oh, I guess not.
I'm watching that shit tonight.
Yeah, it came out on Friday.
I'm watching that shit fucking tonight, yeah. Dude. Did you watch it?
No. Oh. I just remember reading a thing about Aaron Paul talking about how, like, he would keep eating the meth on the set of Breaking Bad because it was cotton candy flavored.
Dude, oh my God, I'm so excited. Oh, and Del Toro almost was going to direct Ozymandias, the third to last episode of Breaking Bad.
Oh.
Yeah, the one when shit goes fucking down, dude. Yeah, but Rian Johnson got directed, unfortunately. The exact quote that Rian Johnson said to Del Toro was, "Sorry, I get to fuck the prom queen." I'm like, fucker.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a little, because I love Del Toro.
That is a zinger.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to have seen Del Toro's version of it, but I think Rian Johnson did an amazing goddamn job.
I'm sure he did great. I haven't seen this episode in question specifically, but.
Wait, have you not finished Breaking Bad?
No.
Oh, shit, dude. Okay, that's one of the best episodes of television of all fucking time. And Del Toro almost directed it.
I understand that, and I'm glad that you're tying it back in. I was watching the last season of Breaking Bad with my brother the last time I was visiting home, but I think I got to, like, the beginning of the second half of season 5.
Fuck. Okay, it's the third to last episode. It's insane. It's insane. I can see why they went between both directors, because the subject matter is fucking dark, dude. And, like, the visuals actually do match a little bit with Devil's Backbone in terms of, like, the set design, the camera movement.
Again, and this is my very brief caveat about Breaking Bad, I watched it in high school. It was not for me in high school. I watched it now as a full-grown 24-year-old, almost, and I liked it a lot more, so I'm going to give it another shot.
Finish that last season, dude.
I will, like, give it another shot.
Fuck me. Okay. I lost my spot. Let's go back into it.
After I ruined Anthony's day by telling him, what was it, El Camino?
El Camino. No, that didn't ruin my day. That made my goddamn day right there.
Informing him about El Camino coming out.
Now I have an agenda today. All right. So at a loss between the seeming failure of Mimic and no one biting on the Devil's Backbone, the eventual solution to Del Toro's problems arrived courtesy of filmmaker Pedro Almodovar.
Yes.
Yes. I got that name right.
You did.
Yeah. Okay, so Almodovar had seen Del Toro's premiere film Kronos in 1994 at the Miami Film Festival and had approached him, telling Del Toro him and his brother would love to produce a movie of his should he ever find himself in Spain. Wow.
Imagine just, like, you know, this is your first movie ever and someone just walks up to you and she's like, if you ever find yourself in Spain and you want someone to produce a movie for you, hit me up.
See, this is Del Toro's, like, Super Mario 1-up right here. Like, he got the green mushroom.
Yeah. Well, this is also just, like, just the power. Well, I mean, it's one, being incredibly fucking lucky.
Yeah.
Two, being good. Yeah. Like, just pure fucking knowing what the fuck you're doing.
Dude, but if you ever talk to any director that fucking made it, they will all keep telling you it is a combination of luck and skill.
Absolutely. Everybody. Yeah.
They're like, luck and skill brought me here. But I couldn't do it without either.
And also, like, to an extent, confident, like, just, like, fucking balls out confidence.
Oh, yeah.
Because read the next one.
Oh, yeah. You need some brazen shit going on there. But so in 1997, Del Toro took him up on his offer and asked if he'd still be interested in producing a movie for him.
Yeah, he's still trying to get this movie fucking produced.
That's
like,
his one up, like, dude.
He's like, I am using this shit.
He used the green mushroom, yes.
Yeah.
Almodovar produced The Devil's Backbone, but gave Del Toro complete creative control over the film, which is fucking... Ooh, that's why it's good. Yeah. That's why it's good right there. An experience Del Toro says was, quote, like an antidote to Mimic. which was five producers around me at all times. So let me adjust. Almodovar also gave Del Toro Final Cut. Fuck.
Yeah.
Another condition that was denied to him on Mimic. That's awesome.
Well, this is also like someone who is a fan of, obviously a fan of his work.
And well, that he sees the potential.
Yeah,
he
of course.
Sees like, dude, just do your thing. Just do your fucking thing because I know that's yeah. going to be good.
So yeah, all of that was just the production.
Oh my God. This is good. Okay, this is good. So while filming, just a little quick film tidbit. If Fernando Tielve was unable to cry, Del Toro would out loud complain of his acting skills and express his disappointment of his work. That's some mean shit right
it's
there.
It's so mean. And also, like, I would cry too, buddy.
Yeah, the fucking director you're trying to impress, he's like, wow, that's shit. That's shit, little boy.
Well, if Guillermo del Toro ever expressed any mild to moderate disappointment in me breathing, I would probably just kill myself you're on like, the spot.
Well, I guess I won't breathe anymore ever again. How about that? How about that?
Are you happy now?
Yeah.
Like, sorry, holy shit.
You won't be disappointed with me anymore. It's like, oh, I forgot who you were already.
I know.
you just start bawling.
I know. It'd be so sad. No, that is so sad, but also, like, very effective.
Oh, man. And then also, as motivation for Jacinto, according to the actor who portrayed him, Eduardo Noriega, quote, what Guillermo did was to write a biography of Jacinto, which went into Jacinto's parents, what they did in life, and more, and gave it to me. Like, that's pretty cool.
So they just wrote his biography and gave it to him, and, like, he used that as, like, the inspiration for his character instead of, like... like, sitting him down and, like, these are your inspirations. This is,
yeah.
like
this is the mood. Be right. this mood. Like, be this mood.
Like, and you just let him come to those, that interpretation himself.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
I mean, it makes sense with, like, this fucking character. Yeah. He's got a chip on his shoulder.
Definitely.
He's got a big chip on his fucking shoulder. The character of Jaime is heavily inspired by the famous Spanish comic writer, Carlos Jiménez.
I know nothing
Don't
about
Don't know that
it,
guy either.
I saw that and I thought that was a fun tidbit and I was like, all right, cool.
All right, well... now that the film is produced
and released and did horribly in the United States anyway.
poor fucking Del Toro. And let us know how that happened.
I know. So the response to The Devil's Backbone was overwhelmingly positive, though it did not receive the critical success that Pan's Labyrinth would in 2006. Our man, Roger Ebert, gave the film 3 stars and ended the review with, Del Toro's symbols work first as themselves, then as what they may stand for. So it does not matter if the audience has never heard of Franco, the dictator in Spain, as long as it has heard of ghosts.
God, he had a really good way of surmising films.
Yeah.
Even if he was, like, okay about them.
Yeah, I kind of went through the entire thing, and I'm like, this last line is, like, kind of hits the nail on the head about, like, everything he went through. He really liked the villain. Like, he really liked Jacinto. He really liked the ghosts and, like, just it being an effective ghost story while also still relaying it to the trauma of the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah,
so I think that was really cool.
That's fucking brilliant, man. And then Santi and all that, like, dude.
Rotten Tomatoes gives the film 92% out of 119 reviews.
Damn.
Which is an impressive feat for even the most illustrious of films.
Out of that many reviews? That's fucking awesome,
dude. Yeah, I mean, it is generally widely considered a great film.
Like, those are close to Toy Story percentages right there.
On Letterboxd, our new favorite, it averages on 3.8% with most of the ratings 4 out of 5 stars out of its over 16,000 reviews.
I bet you all the 1-star reviews are like, build the wall.
No.
No. Oh, there's one right here.
One user, Cinema Clown, saying rather beautifully, an elegant, alluring, and sumptuous poetry from Guillermo del Toro, The Devil's Backbone is crafted with remarkable care, told with great composure, and brims with endless passion to finish as one of the most enchanting works of its genre. Gorgeously rendered, meticulously detailed, and uplifted by sincere performances, it also paints a fascinating portrait of childhood in an era marred by war and violence.
Hey, that guy's not a Cinema Clown at all. He knows his shit.
This is also a 4-star rating. This isn't even a 5-star rating.
Damn.
Yeah.
Damn. Best in the genre. 4 stars.
Christopher Varney of Film Threat claimed, quote, that The Devil's Backbone makes any sense at all with its many swirling plot lines seems like a little wonder.
Yeah, shit. I mean, I'm thinking with a less director or writer, it would not have made any sense at all.
Oh, no. There was a lot going on, and you had to keep up with a lot that was going on because, like, and just how the movie starts and how it ends and everything that goes in between and everything. I was just like...
it's a juggling act. It's a major juggling act.
There's a lot of tabs you have to keep open.
Good point. Yep.
I guess is the best way I can describe it. A.O. Scott of the New York Times gave the film a positive review and claimed that, quote, the director Guillermo del Toro balances dread with tenderness and refracts the terror and sadness of the time through the eyes of a young boy who only half understands what he is witnessing.
Oh.
And I think that's also very apt because it is, it's surprisingly, it's a very tender, wholesome movie for that's both scary and, like, war-torn.
Well, I mean, like, it's a tragic ghost story again.
Right.
Like, it's a total tragedy. But at first, you don't know that.
Right.
Like, it really builds to it.
But it's also, like, about... sorry, my cat
is... Yeah, this cat is, like, loving me right now for some reason. I don't know what's going on.
She's claiming your things as her own.
Oh, great.
She's like... I
have to break her little heart a little bit.
She's like, so you're staying right?
Yeah. Because this is a spot now.
No, I mean, not to be totally mad, or not to, like, totally break everyone's heart, but now she's just like, Papa?
Nah, dude, she's, like, taking owner. This is a fucking Francisco Franco cat right here.
She's a little dictator.
She's a little dictator, huh? A little fascist? But what was your point? You had a thread there.
No, I know. I'm going to cut all of this out.
But... No, put it back. Just go.
Anyway, but no, what I was saying was she, that's my cat, not anyone in this movie. There is, like, two female characters in this entire movie.
Both fucking marked.
Both dead. Yeah. Fucking gone. Both fucking the same evil character.
I know.
Anyway, no, I would, about this film that I thought was really cool is that it has this, like, boyhood, childhood, like, storyline to it that I think is really, like, that scene where they're all kind of, like, out of bed, past lights out, like, looking at comics, being dorky teenage boys. Yeah. I'm just like, okay, this is very Stand By Me. Like,
it is. Oh, sometimes it totally is.
Yeah, like, yeah. I thought that was really cool. And, like, even at the very end when they're all, like, marching off, like, they don't know where they're going. They have technically no one to look after them, and they're kind of, like, the masters of their own destiny at this point. And it's just, like, where do you go from there? Because, like, literally, the people who are set to take care of you have all died.
Yeah.
And then your parents are dead because you're in an orphanage because you're an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
You're like...
Yeah, and they had to be part of society in a war that they... That was done by their superior, their elders. Like, this is their father's war. Yeah,
exactly. One of the synopses for the film said that it was in the final days of the Spanish Civil War. So I don't even know if this was, like... At the very, very end, or...
I don't know either. But, I mean, shit, that's still, like, obviously a grim reality no matter what.
And this is also, even then, if it's the end of the Spanish Civil War, this is right before freaking, like, the fascists take over Madrid and, like, fuck everyone over.
Yeah, exactly. They're coming out with new identities and shit. Yeah.
So, Bloody Disgusting ranked the film at number 18 in their list of the top 20 horror films of the decade.
Damn.
Yeah. With the article calling the film elegant and deeply felt, it's alternatively a gut-wrenching portrait of childhood in a time of war and a skin-crawling evocative nightmare.
Ooh. Yeah, you pulled some solid reviews this time. All right. I dig it.
I did some research.
You did some research.
In 2003, Guillermo del Toro has said that this was his favorite movie of his own so far. I'm pretty sure Pan's Labyrinth probably overshadowed it in 2006, but
yeah.
I don't know what his favorite movie is. I think there was this really cool quote that I saw. I'm actually going to pull it up really quick because I think it's kind of important, where he kind of talks about his, he says about his career and, like, the movies that he's done. He's like... I cannot pontificate about it, but by the time I'm done, I will have done one movie, and that's all the movies I want. People will say, you know, I like your Spanish movies more than I like your English language movies because they're not as personal. And I say, fuck, you're wrong. Hellboy is as personal as personal to me as Pan's Labyrinth. They're totally different. And yes, of course, you can like one more than the other. The other one may seem banal or whatever, but you don't, or whatever it is you don't like. But it really is part of the same movie. You make one movie. Hitchcock did one movie all his life.
Damn.
And he said that in 2013. So,
dude, this is a fucking eloquent ass motherfucker, Del Toro.
Also, what I love is he swears like a goddamn sailor.
Yes,
he's so eloquent, and he curses like a sailor, and I love that because that's how I want to be in life.
Well, the most eloquent motherfuckers do.
Right, but like when he was at Comic-Con, like usually when you're in. like when you present at Comic-Con, like the back of the your little name tag, it says like there are people under 18 in the audience, like watch your fucking language, basically. Yeah. And he did not give a fuck the whole time. He was just like, fuck this, fuck that, bastard bitch, blah 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 blah, shit, fuck, blah blah blah. And I was just bastard like, bitch. Like I was just like, this man is my fucking hero.
Yeah,
like he was so funny, and he cursed, and he was so eloquent, and I was just like, holy shit. Like, I just, I was just in awe.
Yeah.
And to this day, I'm still in awe. Like, he is my fucking hero.
You're like, I want to be able to do that and get the point across.
Yeah. Because, like, that's what he does. He is able to be so concise and beautifully well-spoken and elaborate, but also just curse like a motherfucker.
But, I mean, it's like, not using cursing as a crutch. It's to exemplify his point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that. And it's just, it's so fucking fun to me. And he's great. Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, in 2006, he would release Pan's Labyrinth. And The Devil's Backbone is described by Guillermo del Toro as being a sibling film to Pan's Labyrinth. The Devil's Backbone being the masculine, quote, brother film, and Pan's Labyrinth being the feminine, quote, sister film.
And to discuss that further, one day we'll just have to go ahead and get into that one, wouldn't we?
I would love to cover Pan's Labyrinth. A lot of people consider it more of a fantasy film than a horror film, though.
Oh, but there's some fucking horror-ass elements
I'm sure
in
it's
there.
I mean, it's terrifying. I've seen many clips. Like, I've...
Wait, you haven't seen it, though?
No. Ooh.
Yeah, it's... When they describe this being the brother film and this is the sister film, that's 100%.
Right, and a lot of the visual essays you sent me also were talking about how Pan's Labyrinth also has, like, super intense, like sister, intense, feminine, like, horror imagery, which I think is actually really cool because I have a whole book on the monstrous feminine.
You're going to really like it. So. Yeah, we're gonna. That's going on the list. Sorry, that's happened. So, okay. But that's another day right now,
that
today.
Is another day. Today we are discussing, we are going to wrap up with some discussion about The Devil's Backbone. We've discussed the production, we've discussed the Civil War, we've discussed all of this stuff, we've discussed Guillermo del fucking Toro.
Now
let's talk about the
boy.
Fucking movie.
Oh my god. What'd you think?
I fucking loved it.
Right? I knew you would.
I was very tired when I watched it, but I did enjoy it. There is this one scene, and I just remember, like, because it did traumatize me. There was a point where I was, like, old man falling asleep, where, like, I was watching it, but, like, my eyes were closed, and, like, I was falling asleep. And you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, like, I know. You're glazing over. Yeah.
No, my eyes were closed, and, like, I was listening, but then I could feel myself drifting off.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, shit, I need to open my eyes. And right as I had opened my eyes, it was the scene where our protagonist was hiding. Carlos? Mm-hmm.
Carlos, yeah.
He was hiding in the linen closet, and the ghost was peeping through the keyhole.
Right
as I opened my eyes, his big yellow fucking eye crossed in front of the keyhole, and I was like, well, this is terrifying. Well,
oh,
I'm scared shitless. I'm gonna be awake for the rest of this goddamn movie, and I was, so.
That's all. See? Effective filmmaking right there. Effective.
But no, it was, I loved it. I thought it was surprisingly, I mean, like, it was sad. It was a sad as shit movie, but, like.
Two sad ghost movies this October. Two very sad ghost movies this October.
I know, not intentional, but very different vein.
Both your choices.
Oh, shit. Oh, yeah. Because I did. It was my idea. I was just like, I really want to do a Guillermo del Toro movie. And this was one. This is what we decided. We were going to do Kronos, but then we were like, probably not.
Yeah. No, we're not sure on that one yet.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That is so fucking funny. You're so right. I do have a soft spot for ghost stories. I love a good ghost story.
Yeah.
So.
And these are like ghost stories. These are like these narrative are, fucking like, there's a three acts here.
I think
these
two picks for me are very indicative about what scares me.
Yeah. That's a very true. And they're both two different styles. Foreign film, which most of our foreign films have been your request.
Yes. I typically am the one who pushes the foreign films.
Mm-hmm. That's
right.
Because
I think it's important.
And the found footage.
Yeah. Found footage and foreign and foreign noir.
Yeah, that's what we got this month. But yeah. No, this is a... This was a very good choice. Like, honestly, I love this fucking movie. Like,
I'm glad you liked it. I was, like, a little worried because I was just like, I've never seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like, this seems cool. I like ghosts. I like, technically, I actually don't like war movies. So
don't what?
I don't like war movies.
War movies. I was like, horror movies. You talk about them every week.
No, I don't like war movies.
Oh,
typically,
yeah.
They are not my cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little, like, I was just like, oh, I don't know if this will be. But then I was just like, no, I think this will be good. I'm gonna try. I'm going to branch out.
Yeah.
So, and this was my choice, and I'm glad that I chose it because I actually really enjoyed it because it didn't have that nitty gritty, like, gory violence that war movies have that is usually what makes me so, like, deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, it still is violence, but it's like, it's realistic and you feel it.
You feel it,
but it's not gratuitous.
There is this quote in one of the visual essays we watch about how Guillermo del Toro does violence.
Mm-hmm.
And he, the way the person explained it was like, Guillermo del Toro does violence only to make you empathize with the person violence is being done to. It's never done for gratuitous purposes. And if it's not needed to push the plot, then it's, you don't see it. You only ever see the after effects of it.
Right. It's. I think the quote was, it's not a Bruce Willis wound.
Yes.
It's not a Bruce Willis wound. You're not going to come up after that.
That's a Guillermo del Toro quote. He calls them Bruce Willis wounds.
Yep.
Because then they cut to scenes from, like, Die Hard, where, like, he's getting, like, fucked up left
and
right.
And just,
like,
two
seconds later, he brushes it off.
He still has all the energy and all that shit. Yeah.
And in the visual essay, he talked about when he was younger, he, like, fell on a fence and got stabbed in the armpit.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why in a lot of his movies, he tends to give his villains or gives anyone any really armpit injuries.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jacinto gets stabbed in the fucking armpit, I was like, oh God.
That hurt.
I, like, even though I thought he was a piece of shit and he deserved to die, I felt that shit.
Yeah. I was like, can't you just kill him faster?
And then they just stab him with sticks. It was very Lord of the Flies.
It was so... this is a very Lord of the Flies-y kind of movie, though. Except it's very anti-fascist.
Yeah.
Lord of the Flies, you can kind of flip a coin sometimes.
Yeah, depending on how you want to read it.
Depending on how you want to read it, yeah. But this is very much just like, no. Those savage kids would have fucking died.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But no, I honestly, the first time I saw this movie was on Netflix, back when you can just get DVDs.
Oh, so you've seen it before?
Oh, yeah. I've seen it a couple times.
Oh.
I got it back... Oh, after I saw Pan's Labyrinth. I saw Pan's Labyrinth when it came out.
Oh, and you were just like, I have to watch everything Guillermo del Toro's ever done.
I got Netflix. And then it was one of the first ones. It was the TV show Undeclared. I got the two-disc option, and I got disc one of season one of Undeclared because I had wanted to watch it from when I was a kid, and I got The Devil's Backbone. Those were the two that I bought. So I got to watch Judd Apatow, Jay Baruchel... 4 episodes, whatever, on the DVD, and then I put The Devil's Backbone right after that shit.
Two very different.
Very different.
That was a genre shift. I think your mood probably shifted tremendously.
Oh, yeah. But no, man, like, but I watched it again. I watched it again at the Frida Cinema, and, like, the Frida does
you
sound so well.
You saw it at the Frida?
Oh, I got lit from that fucking bar, right?
The brewery right above it?
Yeah. And then I went to go watch this shit, and I was like, dude, the sound design in the Frida's really good.
Oh, yeah, this is the first time we've recorded since,
Oh, Camp Frida,
since Camp Frida.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then also, yeah, so I'll talk about that probably at the end.
Yeah.
I'll give a little summary.
Yeah. Which is, again, if you're SoCal residents, go to the Frida Cinema. Support your independent fucking local theater. Please.
It's so fucking fun.
And they play amazing movies like the fucking Devil's Backbone in HD, 4K, whatever thing you can put on. And they do the best sound. And it's amazing. And this movie, seeing it again, it was so much better the second time seeing it in theaters.
Yeah.
And then watching it again, this time with my projector set up, I was even again enthralled. It's just a fundamental... It's Del Toro as Del Toro can Del Toro. This is like...
Definitely.
It's amazing.
I think that for this one, it was kind of hard for me to get into it because I'm just like, foreign film, plug in your fucking phone, don't look at your phone. Like, just stop it.
Yeah, don't look at your phone at all. What if you're watching this?
Yeah,
unless you know Spanish.
Yeah, that was one of those things where I also like was just I totally forgot to mention it up top. If you have not seen this movie, watch this fucking movie. Do yourself a favor. It's so fucking good.
It's $4 on every streaming service. You can spare $4. Don't buy a coffee. Just buy this movie. Yeah.
It is. It's also supposed to be on Shudder, but it's not working right now, which is annoying.
It's probably a placeholder. It's coming in a month.
Right. I think that the. Anyway, the point is I did not, like, the beginning, I kept having to go back because I was, like, I would keep getting distracted by my phone, and that was to my own detriment, so I kept having to go back, so it really took me, like, 2 hours to watch the fucking movie. I also kept having to pause it because I was, like, shit, and then I kept wanting to, like, go back and, like, rewatch, like, I'm, like, did that just happen? And, like, I kept going back, which was kind of fun. But I did really enjoy it. It was a very fun, I don't want to say fun, but it was like, it was an enjoyable movie to like watch, especially for me to watch it. This is the first movie I've watched with like an analytical eye mm-hmm. in a very long time.
Really?
Like usually like when we watch movies for the podcast, I'm just like, okay, I'm going to let the movie happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one I was like trying to like pick apart the movie as I was watching
You're
it.
Like Spanish Civil War, Del Toro, blah, 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 these influences. Yeah.
I was trying to pick it apart as I was watching it, which normally I don't do. Like I usually try to let the movie take me where it wants to take me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I
mean, that's part of the experience. Yeah. That's right. How you should watch the film normally. But yeah. But this, no, this is inviting to that type of lens.
Yeah. And I think and then also because that's just what I was used to from like college. Like mm-hmm. I was always used to always watching a movie with like a, I'm going to tear this apart with like a fine tooth comb kind of feel.
Oh yeah. In college, I remember like learning about like cinematography and then suddenly every film I had to watch for like 3 months, I was just like, oh, they used that angle. They did this and that's, oh, okay. They panned it and blah, blah, blah. And like, I'm like, just enjoy the movie. Just enjoy the movie.
I'm so glad I never had to learn like the names of like angles or shots or anything. Like mm-hmm. people would use them in like papers or like my professors would use them. So
mid shot, close up, all that stuff.
Like that kind of stuff. Like
Dutch angle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what that is, but like I would kind of get an idea of like what they were. But I'm glad I never had to like actively study them because I think that would also, the same thing would happen to me where I'm like, I know what that is. Yeah. I know how they did that. I know like the technique they used to get that look or
it's
whatever.
It's hard to wean off that. It really is. Yeah, honestly, like, I mean, sometimes, you know what, actually, when it comes back to me is when I'm watching a bad movie. But when I'm watching a bad movie, I look at it, I'm like, oh, you could have done so much more with that. Why the fuck did you do that shit?
Like, you could have done this shot and it would have like looked so much cooler.
Oh my gosh.
That's cool though. I mean, that's fun. Yeah. Everyone likes talking shit.
Right?
Everyone's a critic.
But like a good movie, I usually don't anymore. Mm. But college, no, I was an asshole. You know how it is.
Yeah, no, I get it. I was a super critical asshole. That's one of the things that like one of my professors really did like about me is because mm-hmm. I had no formal training in like film studies at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I would read everything super strangely, like not intentionally, but that's just kind of how I would just read things.
Yeah, natural to you.
Yeah, and like my professor was just like, how did you get that? And I was just like, this way. And she's just like, huh. And that's just how I got into film theory, because I just read things like a fucking freak.
That's your thing right there. That's it.
That's how I got very into
natural,
film theory.
Right, yeah. But what did you actually know about the Spanish Civil War before watching this movie?
So we talked about this, but I knew nothing. I knew nothing?
Nothing?
Literally nothing. This is like, yeah.
Damn.
Maybe I read a sentence about it, and there mm-hmm. maybe there was a single question on it in, like, one of my high school history classes, but, like, on, like, a test or something.
But, like, nothing that stuck.
No, yeah. Nothing stuck. Like, nothing that I had retained from, like, world history or nothing I'd retained in, like, I took a world history college class. Like, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Literally nothing I've retained. Like, sitting down to write this, I was just like, this is all new information. But I feel like I learned a lot.
Yeah.
Because at least now I know, like, what this was and, like, what was going on in history at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know, I feel like it's important to, like, at least know, because this is, like, something that, like, happened going into World War II, and it's so often, like we mentioned before, just swept under the rug.
It is, no, yeah. But, I mean, that's, for me, I watch a lot of history YouTube videos, and I watch a lot of stuff. Mostly, I've been on a big Russian history kick lately.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Russian history's fucking metal as fuck, dude. It's metal as shit.
I mean, it's super metal. It's just, a lot of it is just, like, I don't know what it is, because, like, for example, last podcast did a whole, like, a five-part or four-part series on, like, Rasputin,
yeah.
And, like,
Russian Revolution, the Romanovs.
Yeah. I could not get through it.
Oh, dude, I would love that series. That's my favorite. One of my favorites.
I could not get through it. I was I don't know what it is.
Yeah, Russian Revolution. Well, see, that's the thing, though. Like, this comes during a time when fascism was, like, it's going from old royalty to democracy.
Right.
And that transitional time, our grandparents lived through that. Mm-hmm. That's why they're so fucking aggressive. Because they're used to, like, just things getting taken care of. Mm-hmm. Although, brutally. And
yeah.
For if you're on the other end of that shit, obviously it's fucking horrible. But I knew mostly from the Spanish Civil War, because even in videos that I watch about World War II, it is still a footnote. Like, the thing, it does not get as much credit as it normally should, realistically.
And by the way, in Spain, the Spanish Civil War was happening.
Well, yeah, that, or they'll talk about it briefly, and then it'll go into, but then World War II happened, and fucking forget everything we did there.
Yeah.
And go into, you know, World War II and how everybody had to adapt to that going on.
That was something I kind of wanted to do, like, more research on, and I don't know if you know the answer, but, like, was Spain, I don't know, was Spain super involved in World War II?
I think they
were,
but
they kind of just, like, doing their own thing after. because of the Civil War.
It's, I mean, I don't, they weren't one of the big players.
Yeah, really. I know most of the big players. I do remember that much from history.
Yeah. Again, they're usually not referenced that much. Yeah. Like, shit happens. I think what they had that campaign in Africa, North Africa, if I remember correctly. I could be wrong.
Because... I was talking to my friends about World War II, because, mm-hmm. you know. Friends,
yeah.
And I was explaining, I was just like, end of it, right? Mm-hmm. And they were just like, what? I was like, yeah, like once it started tipping in the favor of the allies, they were just like, okay, let's finish this shit
and
off,
let's take the credit for it.
Yeah. And they were just like, oh, because I think one of my friends was like, oh yeah, when did World War II start? And I was like, oh, like it started in 1939. And he was like, I thought it started in like the 40s. And I was like,
no. It went into the 40s.
It ended in 45. Mm-hmm. But, and they were just like, oh, and I was like, but it only, America didn't get into it until the 40s.
Yeah, no, we didn't get into it until Pearl Harbor. Yeah. Pearl Harbor got us, yeah.
And we're not a history podcast. We're not,
no, yeah. But no, I've always known about that Francisco Franco was a piece of shit. That's one thing I remember very staunchly was like, it was very contentious, him making it. The Civil War was a war. It was a big ideological shift.
Gotcha.
Like, and I mean, a lot of these countries too back then, like, they really were going between straight up fascism and like a cult of personality leader leading the country. But no, this comes during a time literally like the cult of personality stuff people talk about, that is a driving force for a lot of these things too. I mean, there's rural, like, people that just like, listen, like, we don't know, like, nothing's working, so we got to do something.
Yeah.
And then this person that talks all fucking brash and just crushes the people you hate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can see, like, why a lot of Del Toro's villains are straight up fucking assholes. They're little Francisco Francos.
Yeah.
They're little oppressive motherfuckers.
This, one of the other visual essays, again, the ones you sent me were amazing.
Oh, thank you.
I loved them. They were great. It was, they compared the villains, and it was Shape of Water.
Oh, I still haven't seen that. That's why I didn't watch that video.
Oh, you still haven't seen The Shape of Water?
I have the Blu-ray. I have it. I have it in my fucking apartment right now. But I gotta watch El Camino, sorry.
I mean, I'm not gonna say watch it today.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if it's a watch it today kind of movie. I think you have to, like, be prepared for it.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed it. I did really like it. But when you're ready, mm-hmm. The Shape of Water is really good.
Okay.
And the villain, I know his name.
No details. Just say the villain in The Shape of Water.
The villain in The Shape of Water. He has a very similar, character trope, or not character archetype, as the main guy from Pan's Labyrinth, as mm-hmm. the main evil guy from The Devil's Backbone. Like,
really?
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's all kind of tied in together as like this. They explained it in the video very, very well, so mm-hmm. I'm really bummed that you didn't watch it. Watch The Shape of Water, watch the video, it's all very cool.
I will make a point to do all that, or before we cover Shape of Water, should we do that in the future?
Is it not horror? It's not a horror film.
Oh, fuck it then. All right, I'll just do it on my own then.
The Shape of Water is not a horror film, in my opinion.
Okay, well, we will see when I watch it.
I think you'll agree with me.
I probably will. No, you're right.
I definitely think you're going to agree with me. But it has a monster. Yeah, but like...
No spoilers.
I know. I was going to say something, and then I was going to keep my opinions to myself.
Well, now I have to watch it as soon as possible. All right. Yeah. So the movie opens and ends with the same monologue, both used for different reasons and to elicit different emotions. What did you think about this?
I loved it.
Nice little bookend right there.
The exact word I was going to use was like, I love a good bookend. Yeah. Like, the bookend was amazing. I thought that was mm-hmm. so cool. Because, like, in the beginning, like, it's giving you all of this information, and you're kind of, because it's the beginning of the movie, your first thing is, like, trying to piece all of it together. And then at the end of it, it's just sad because, like, obviously you see this guy as, like, a ghost, like, watching them walk away. And just, like, he's obviously doomed to stay there forever.
Right. And they're like, and at the beginning, they're technically they're going towards safety, mm-hmm. what they think is safety. Yeah. And then, like, when they leave, they're leaving this fucking wreck that they've just had. And it's very poetic.
Definitely.
It feels incredibly poetic, which is, I'm glad they gave Del Toro the complete creative control for this shit. Like, honestly.
It paid off
like a motherfucker. And it's why you gotta do that sometimes, because these movies last. Like, the reputation where it is, like, people will still look for a way to watch The Devil's Backbone.
Definitely.
But when you start Weinsteining it, nobody's fucking clamoring and video essays or whatever it is. I mean, some people Mimic. About Mimic. Yeah, it's just, it's a footnote.
Well, and usually when they're talking about Mimic, they're talking about how Miramax and the Weinsteins fucked him over.
Yeah, that's the reputation it got. I mean, to be fair, they didn't know they were coming into the digital age and all that shit would be out there. They probably think they could sweep it under the rug like all the other fucking fascists. Ugh, stupid ass Weinsteins. All right.
But yeah, no, I really loved the monologue. I just think it was, it's a beautiful monologue.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, I just think it was very well done, in my opinion. So the entire film, over the course of it, there's a huge disarmed bomb in the middle of the orphanage. What did this mean to you, and did your interpretation change as you watched any of the visual essays that we watched?
Well, it always seemed like a red herring to me.
Okay.
Like, when I first watched it on the Netflix thing, I was, like, scared of the bomb the whole movie.
Like, you thought it was gonna, like...
I thought it was gonna pop off. I thought something was gonna happen. I thought all this shit. And then by the end of it, like, there's obviously way more to the story than a simple bomb that could go off and fuck everything up. That's just my American sensibilities of how films usually go.
And bombs.
And bombs, yeah. But, I mean, it's kind of like... When it gave the context to... what was his name? Jaime?
Yeah.
Yeah, when you see Jaime's, like, flashback there a little bit, I'm just like... Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, like it's it basically is like the bomb changed the game. Like once the bomb came into it, even though it didn't actively do anything, their world had as if a bomb had actually dropped.
Yeah. Yes. It's like a super literal metaphor for it is. Like a bomb dropping, and it was I thought that was cool. I did also assume that the bomb at some point was going to go off.
Mm-hmm.
So I was super hyper focused on it the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's very funny because Guillermo del Toro like wanted it to be like this like super like hyper feminine like symbol and
really?
It was, yeah like a toy because like they were hanging stuff off of it like kids were playing around it and they just like never fucking moved it and I just thought that was so funny to me because like you know you see the kids playing in the courtyard and like there's just this fucking bomb and I think it also appeals not appeals but like it's interesting to us as just like people who live in America because we have never had to deal with like bombs falling
on our
people.
No, we're not a total war nation. No. We're geographically that's not our thing. Yeah.
That is we drop bombs on other people but bombs are not dropped on us. Like, no, you know. Yeah. So I think that was just like also just a visually interesting element where it's just like there's a literal bomb in the middle of a courtyard where children are playing and everyone acts like it's totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting for me just like as an American who's just like that's never something I've ever had to consider deal with even think about.
Right? And then also there's something about it being disarmed but still being a menacing kind of figure in the middle of the thing. And it's like...
Because, like, they tease Carlos about it. They're like, you can still, like, she's still ticking, like, if you listen or, you know, that kind
of
shit.
But, like, technically it's not supposed to be. So it's one of those things where... And it kind of it goes with the ghost, too. Like, you're not supposed to really believe in the ghost. Mm-hmm. The ghost can't be real, whatever it is. Like, if you look at it from the very, very grounded perspective, but then... You know, this ghost obviously is there. It is a bomb. It is a threat that could go off.
Definitely.
At least seemingly. But the real threat is motherfucking Jacinto.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing. It's like he literally blows them up at the end.
Wait, what?
Jacinto.
Oh, yeah, he does. That's right.
So
that's
right. It's like, but he uses like gasoline. Like, you know, so he kind of creates his own bomb.
He does.
That also, that whole thing was so fucking sad when that whole thing goes down and like there's just like lit, like, bodies of dead children all over.
Dead kids, dude. This movie does dead kids like a motherfucker. Well. Yeah. Yeah. And I always appreciate a good dead kid in a movie. Have the balls to kill off all beings.
Have the balls to show the dead children. But, no, and what was so interesting about that is also the children who did survive, like, all of the injuries that they sustained, like, followed them through the rest of the film.
To walking out, dude.
Yeah.
To walking out in the elements.
Was, again, not a diehard injury. Mm-mm. Like, it was, or a Bruce Willis injury or whatever. It was a very, like, it was very intentional. Like, the kid who broke his ankle, like, when he fell, like, that, oh, I felt that.
Ooh, yeah.
When he, like, I thought he just rolled his ankle, and I was like, ooh, and then it was just like, oh, no, he fucked up his ankle.
Oh, my gosh.
Or, like, the kid who had, like, shrapnel in his back, mm-hmm. and like all of that. Like, I was just like, all of this was intentional and done so well.
And these are like also emotionally traumatized kids.
Yeah,
they are getting it from all different types of angles here.
They're getting it from all sides. Like, their parents are dead, and there's the trauma involved with, like, you know, your dad basically being killed in a war, mm-hmm. and like not really understanding what that
not
means.
Understanding it. No, they're born into a war that their elders are fucking fighting. Yeah. And they have to pick a side, and they're children, and they want to read comic books.
Yeah,
and
like. Just trying to figure their shit out. And then at the end, they're like basically just left to fend for themselves and figure their own shit out.
Mm-hmm. And they have this mysticism of a ghost still present, and they know there's a presence. Yeah. There's no things you don't do. And like that plays
they
on.
They call the ghost the one who sighs.
Right? And it's this childhood, like, this is like they are in it. Like, yeah. They know it, and they're the most in tune with what a ghost is.
Again, very Stand By Me. A lot of the, yeah. like, a lot of the scenes.
A lot of Stand By Me. That's
a
right.
A lot of just the children. And, like, a lot of the scenes with just the children. It, mm-hmm. it has this very fraternal feel to it.
Yeah.
And I actually enjoyed it quite a bit.
That's why you have to watch Pan's Labyrinth, man. Like, it is like the feminine angle yeah. on this type of story.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested in watching it. I think it'll be very fun.
I'm gonna find that goddamn Blu-ray. Anyways. I have a question that's not on here.
Yeah,
actually.
Go ahead.
What did you think of Jacinto. Jacinto as a character, what kind of role do you feel like he plays within? Because the characters around Jacinto, beside Pig and his other henchmen,
uh-huh.
they're innocent characters. They're flawed, broken kind yeah. of people and children, but they need Jacinto.
Yeah.
They need him. So,
honestly, I didn't even think he was, like, I thought he was, like, kind of a scumbag, but I didn't think he was, like, evil
mm-hmm.
Until he went completely off the rails batshit.
Yeah.
Until he tried to blow them up. I was just like, oh, so you're like crazy, crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like, well, she called him, you were always the most tragic orphan. You always yeah. had the worst story. And I'm just like, holy shit, dude. Like, how do you expect him to get any better
again,
being
I
told
was,
that?
I know. But also, like, he, yeah. I, that was just, it was very hard for me to just, well, nothing was particularly difficult about his character for me to understand. It was mm-hmm. It was an interesting dynamic because it's not an archetype that you see often.
Yeah.
Because, like,
although in Mexican cinema, they have, he is that piece of shit.
Well, but I don't see that here very often.
No, you don't. It's not an American thing, no.
He's, like, this, like, super hot, like, he's, like, you know, and he has, like, this fiancé,
mm-hmm.
and, like, they're doing their thing.
He's the hyper-masculine figure.
Super hyper-masculine. And then the only time, like, I was really, like, kind of caught off guard at first, where I would kind of got, like, I was just, like, these, like, red flags, where mm-hmm. I'm just, like, you're not just eye candy. I think yeah. you're an actual character.
Mm-hmm.
Is when they're in the basement, and he comes down, and he cuts, face on the cheek?
Carlos?
Yeah, Carlos in the cheek after they are, like, fighting with, like, the knife or whatever.
Yeah.
He's just like, get the fuck out of here. And I was like, oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
You are not okay.
No, he's a dictator without power.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a little bit of power because he's, like,
well, I mean,
he's fucking the headmistress.
But even then, he's like, of course he has, like, power because he's fucking with children.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. The thing is, like, he has this, like, weird occasional vulnerability, yeah. but his hyper-masculine kind of, like, way of presenting himself does not allow him to divulge into that. So he goes to the opposite side and goes rage.
Yeah.
Like, when he was having sex with the headmistress. And
that
he
was also, like, weird.
Weird, right?
Because also, Dr. Guy was on the other side of the wall and could hear them fucking.
He's in love with her.
He's in love with her, but he also can't get a fucking erection.
Fucking novella. No, but, like, there's a part where he wants to kiss her in the face. And she's like, no, not the face. Like,
yeah.
don't do that. And you can tell, like, that was, like, an instinctual reaction for him to want to do that.
Yeah.
And he wasn't able to do that. And then he goes to the mirror and just starts fucking, like, talking about the gold
and taking like a key so he could go look for it.
Yeah. So,
and I was just like, you have, one, mommy issues up the wazoo.
Yeah.
Two, have weird rejection issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, you need to, like, I mean, obviously, like, you need to deal with your shit.
Yeah. I mean, but that's that dictator mentality right there. But at the same time, like,
if he doesn't get what he wants, he immediately goes into, like, dickhead mode.
Yeah. Like, he's a very, very flawed way of asking for things that might be a little sentimental. Like, he will not allow himself to cross that line. And when he does, he's built up such a reputation that he'll get slapped away. He gets slapped away easy because people only see him as the thing he's putting out.
Yeah.
This hyper-masculine, I'm in charge, whatever, everything goes my fucking way kind of attitude. And the people who he gets to bully are all, they're all the victim. They're all under him, like in physically or whatever mm-hmm. it is, like they have to rely on him. So yeah. he's a good analog for that Francisco Franco fucking dictator piece of shit kind of character. Ugh. But
that was a great question.
Complex and layered.
the characters, like, they have like their archetypes, but also like the characters themselves are very layered and, mm-hmm. and they have very distinct personalities, and I really like that.
Yeah,
because like, again, it's like ghost stories, but also like it is. I mean, this movie is categorized as a drama horror film, and like you feel that it is a drama horror film. Like, yeah, the emphasis on the characters and like their storylines and mm-hmm. just what's going on historically at the time in the film, I think, is really impactful.
So we touched on this briefly, but would you consider this a horror film, a ghost story, a war story, an amalgamation of all, and what percentages? How would you look at this film overall genre-wise? How would you pitch this to somebody?
I would say this is 25% horror film, 25% ghost story, 50% drama.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that is my distribution
mm-hmm.
because it's like it has a lot of horror elements to it, and it's very like it has that like
more in the beginning than anything
yeah
else.
But yeah. it has like this like gothic-y feel to it still.
It does,
like,
it yes.
has a very, and you can tell that Guillermo del Toro has like super like he loves his gothic like mm-hmm. motifs and a feel for things, but it also ultimately is a ghost story because like it's a story of this boy who was wrongfully murdered by mm-hmm. this piece of shit. And he also, the ghost story part also comes from him getting his vengeance
yes.
against Jacinto at the, mm-hmm. by the end of the movie. And then it also is a drama,
mm-hmm.
but the drama and the war story, I think, kind of are intermingled.
Yeah.
Because like, the
war is a backdrop.
Right. The war is a backdrop to the drama.
Yeah. Yeah. And the drama, again, like we were talking about with Mungo, and like, where was it, Mungo? Yeah, where you have layered characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have characters that have real conversations and motivations and that are not, like, archetypical. I mean, they are archetypes,
yeah.
but they're a take on them.
Them. Yeah, these characters are, like, so well done, it makes the characters from Lake Mungo seem shallow.
Oh, it does, huh? It does. It absolutely does.
Like, just
does.
Thinking about it, because you were just out quiz when you said that, I'm like, definitely you were talking about Lake Mungo, but like, just thinking about it now, I'm just like, there's no way we actually said that, but, like, these characters in comparison, like, I'm like, it is...
It's night and day.
Mm-hmm.
Night and day. No, absolutely. But, yeah, I think... I like your percentages there. I think it is 25% horror, 25% ghost, and then mostly drama, but drama that is enhanced by both of those elements. Those
Definitely.
Elements come into play as their story
yeah.
is happening, which makes things far more complicated and far more gruesome, obviously. Which is, well, the violence, again, like, just
it's
fucking
so
insane.
It's so impactful.
Impactful. Impactful is a good perfect word.
It's impactful, and it's done well. It's not done gratuitously, which is something that Guillermo del Toro does so well. And again, we watched a visual essay about like how he does violence, and he talks about violence in the essay is on Devil's Backbone, Shape of Water, and
Pan's Labyrinth,
and Oof. It's done super fucking well.
God, there's one scene in Pan's Labyrinth that still to this day when I see it, I'm just like, oh. Ooh, couldn't get away with that in American film. Could not get
really?
Away with it. Yeah. And it's not like a huge... Again, American films get real graphic,
what
but it's
scene?
Played... did you see... Did they have it in the video?
That's why I'm asking.
Cheat cut.
Oh, yeah, they show it.
Cheat cut, dude.
Yeah.
Ugh. In the... When
I
watch
it... It looks intense.
It's
like,
so insane.
It looks really scary.
Oh, but there's even a part later on with the... wound still mm-hmm. patched up. Oh, you gotta watch it. You just gotta watch it.
I think you're really gonna like Shape of Water.
Oh, I can't wait. Can't wait.
But, so I think that's about it. How would you rate this film out of 5 gold bars hidden in the safe?
5.
5 out of 5?
This is 5 gold bars. This is 5 gold bars with Pan's Labyrinth. Spoiler, also 5 gold bars. Yeah. Those two are a pair for
I
me.
I know that I feel like I'm like total cop out, like giving my movies that I picked 5 out of 5, but I think I'm also gonna give this one a 5 out of 5.
Yeah, right? That's the Alex Webster thing right there, guys. She didn't give 5 out of 5 for a shit, but this month, Hocus Pocus and Devil's Backbone, two back-to-back 5 out of 5s right there.
So it's been a good week. It's been a good month for us.
I think it has been also.
Because even Lake Mungo, I don't even think I gave it a 5 out of 5.
No, no, it was lower. It was like 3.5 or whatever. I think, yeah,
probably. This was really fucking good. Like, yeah. I was so hyped to write this fucking episode.
And after
I was
seeing it,
so
right?
So hyped, yeah, to talk to you about it because we didn't get to talk about it.
No,
at all.
No, we didn't.
So I fucking loved it. So, man, to end the episode, the quote that ended and bookended the movie was, what is a ghost? A tragedy condemned to repeat itself time and time again. An instant of pain, perhaps. Something dead which seems to be alive. An emotion suspended in time. Like a blurred photograph. Like an insect trapped in amber.
Damn.
So fucking good.
And that also could apply to fascism. That could apply
war. It could apply, like, this quote is like, replace ghost with like fascism, war, like
anything that these characters are going through, like
famine,
honestly,
whatever. Yes, like, it exactly. It could apply to a lot. So, any final praises you would like to sing?
Just, and if you guys have not seen this movie, I'm sure we spoiled some of it, but we didn't talk a lot about the ghost stuff, or like, so there's so much more to the film that we haven't touched on.
No.
And you guys really need to watch it. And then watch Pan's Labyrinth, like, right afterwards. Yeah. Like, just see them both.
Yeah. Back to back, I think this would be a fantastic double feature.
Oh, it'd be amazing.
You'd be very sad. But, yeah. And if you can, and this is actually, I would actually recommend this. These are sober movies.
No, be sober. Yes.
These are sober movies. Yeah. Like, I think I would say maybe, like, a glass of wine or something. But, like, these are sober movies. Like, don't get shit-faced for these movies.
I may have gotten a little. I may have been a little drunk when I watched.
But I mean, like a little, but not like you know. You weren't like plastered, right?
Yeah, I wasn't like laid out on the fucking concrete floor and shit. Yeah.
So, but I think, yeah, I highly recommend watching this movie. This is one of my first episodes in a while where I haven't done a plot like breakdown, which I'm kind of bummed about. But like, I think I did you guys a favor. Go watch the fucking movie. It just, I can't even put it into words, like. Because there's so many layers and subplots in this movie that it's really hard to concisely summarize everything in like a nice little bow.
And it's early Del Toro, so you see a lot of elements of Del Toro that you'll see in his later films. Yeah. Like, it's literally just the camera movement, the character archetypes. Like, this shit is pure Del Toro.
If you want to see, like, raw Del Toro.
Raw Del Toro.
Like, Del Toro without the, like, $17 million budget that, like, Pacific Rim got. Like, watch this movie. Like, it's so fucking good.
Oh, my God. And then next week, you motherfuckers.
Oh, yeah.
You know what next week is. You know what next week is. We do it every 6 months. I'm going to probably could spoil it right now, but, I mean, the name of the day.
I mean, next week, it happens every October. We're, I don't know, everyone's really excited for it. Yeah, it's that time of year.
Been using the hashtag a little bit.
Be excited for it, because we're fucking covering it, so.
Yeah, and it's obviously a continuing story of one of our favorite directors, which we always call back to. Last year's Big Dog, obviously.
Mentioned him earlier in the episode.
Just be ready for it. Yeah. It'll be fun. Good old Hollywood bullshit.
Yeah, so that was The Devil's Backbone from 2001, directed by Guillermo del Toro, my hero.
Yep.
Let's see. So before we wrap up, yeah, so next week, obviously, it's a very special holiday for the horror community. We're very thrilled. It's going to be a great, great time.
Mm-hmm.
And then real quick, before we go through all the normal announcements, I did just want to say, I did Camp Frida a couple of weeks ago, last week. By the time we were recording this comes out, it probably would have been like 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But I had an amazing fucking time.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony has already expressed that probably couldn't do it. But yeah. And I thought I couldn't either, but I can't believe I stayed the whole 12 hours, dude. Like, it was amazing. I had so much fun. I did fall asleep during Season of the Witch.
Yeah.
I did fall asleep because the last movie that they played was Season of the Witch, and I did fall asleep watching it for about 20 minutes.
You need the power nap.
They also showed Army of Darkness.
That's such a good one.
It was very good. Such a good one. It was so fun. But there was, like, the very end battle sequence. I did take a couple power naps until there was an explosion, and that did wake me up. I kept taking some disco naps.
Oh.
But no, it was a great time. I watched movies that I'd never seen before because it forced me to watch movies that I'd never seen before. I watched Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Damn.
Which, if you know me and you know my feelings on Nightmare on Elm Street, you know this was a challenge for me, but I actually really loved it. I had a great time.
And then you watched that one nostalgic movie.
The Craft.
The Craft.
I watched The Craft. I also watched The Witches from 1991.
Damn, man. They went fucking old school on
that. Yeah, they did. They also did show Hocus Pocus, but I didn't watch it because I had just watched it like 2 days before. Because we had recorded the episode on it that day. So I was like, I'm not watching Hocus Pocus again. as much as I love Thackeray Binks. But no, it was a great time. If you ever have the opportunity to go, please check out the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana. They are an amazing nonprofit independent theater, and they deserve your money.
Absolutely.
So go watch a movie and enjoy yourself, because it's so fun. It's just fun. Just always fun. Every time I go, I always have a great time. And there's a brewery above the theater, so go grab a beer, go watch a movie. Have fun. And
a good Mexican restaurant with the spiciest fucking tacos ever. Just right around the corner.
Yeah.
Oh my god, those tacos.
And then there's the little market down the street, so it's fun.
Yeah, oh my god, I gotta do another movie there. Just totally do.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a fun time. So anyway, thank you everyone for joining us this week for the Horrible People's Podcast. We will catch you next week. In the meantime, the biggest compliment you can give us is a 5-star rating on iTunes.
Yep, that's true.
It means the world to us, and it helps us stay on top of the algorithm. Mm-hmm.
And gives us the will to live.
Yeah.
It gives us the will to live.
On top of defeating the dreaded algorithm and fascism, it does give us the will to live. So please continue with your ongoing support. It does mean so, so much to us. Mm-hmm. If you like what you heard and want to stay up to date with all of the latest and greatest going on in the Horrible People Podcast universe, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter. You can find us on Instagram at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORRORBLE People's Podcast. And then you can find us on Twitter at Horror People Pod. You can find Anthony on Twitter and Instagram at Hyrulean Hustler.
And we'll tweet one day. One day he will tweet again.
I don't think so, but it's okay. And then you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ghost Coffee Shop. And I think that is about it.
I think we're good.
Have a fantastic rest of your week, and we will see you next Wednesday.
Yep, and fuck fascism. Adios.
Bye, guys.